Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne is brought to you in part by Evergreen Realty. Commercial and residential property listings. Online at evergreen-realty.com.
Hello, and welcome to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne here at 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho. I am Dr. Joanne, and I hope you'll enjoy the medical topics that I've chosen to present at 8 a.m. the first Monday of every month. You can also catch the show at 8 a.m. on the third Monday, and our show and every show at KRFY is on your radio at 88.5 FM, or can be streamed from anywhere in the world at krfy.org. You could also listen to podcasts of the show if you prefer podcasts. Just go to krfy.org and select the podcast tab. April is Child Abuse Prevention Month, as designated in 1983 by President Ronald Reagan. As with many medical diagnoses, child abuse prevention has its own color. That designation is blue, and the blue pinwheel has become the national symbol of child abuse prevention and awareness. Wearing blue was the idea of a Virginia grandmother in memory of her grandson, who was a victim of fatal maltreatment. I have here with me in the studio Tammy Undiemi, family nurse practitioner and chief nursing officer in pediatrics at Kinnickso Community Health, along with two representatives from CASA, Court-Appointed Special Advocates. I always have to think about that. Jesse Sheldon and Kristen Ludwig. I'd love to have you tell the audience more about yourselves. Tammy, why don't you start?
Thank you, Dr. Joanne. As she mentioned, my name is Tammy Undiemi. I am a nurse practitioner. I actually graduated nursing school back in 2005, and since then spent most of my career in the emergency room. And in 2009, took a class called forensic nursing, thinking it was just like everything else that nurses take, ACLS, PALS. Little did I know it would be a unique skill set, but here we are. Throughout the years, I've treated victims of violent crime, including child abuse, human trafficking, sexual assault, domestic violence, been involved in multiple different child advocacy centers or family justice centers across the U.S. And something that I think really stands out to me is how most people think of abuse in any way, shape, or form as somewhere else or in another time, but they don't realize it's everywhere. Every state, every city that I've worked in, it's all the same, no matter how big or small. And these victims, these are life-changing events for them. And so having organizations such as CASA and family justice centers is really important to make sure that we are addressing all of their needs and not letting anything fall through the cracks.
It's so interesting that part of your training when we spoke included like photographs and the chain of evidence to the police and then to the courts, obviously. So that's a very thorough training, and it's so very important. Kristen and Jesse, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourselves?
Hi, Dr. Joanne. Thanks for having us this morning. My name is Kristen Linville-Ludwig. I am the Director of Development at North Idaho CASA. We are the first judicial district covering all five northern counties. We advocate for child abuse victims in court. We like to say that our advocates are ordinary people that do extraordinary things. Representing child victims is so important because they are the voice of the child in court, and our end goal is to get every child into a safe and loving home and environment.
It's wonderful. And Jesse?
Yes, my name is Jesse Sheldon, and I have been the advocate supervisor here in Bonner County for the past 6 years. Our job is to support 20 volunteer advocates that serve both Bonner and Boundary County, and those advocates will state the best interest for the child in court. And I'm just so excited to be a part of this organization. It has been a wonderful opportunity and has been a natural progression. My past experience has been doing domestic violence probation as well as juvenile probation. I was a foster parent for a little over 3 years. And so I really do have a passion for serving children that are at risk.
Yeah, you come at it from all angles, so that's a very, I'm sure that's very important as you train the volunteers too. Also in the studio with us is Susie Perez from our morning show here at KRFY. I call her my executive producer. She enables us to offer these discussions. Hi, Susie, and thanks for being here.
Well, good morning, Dr. Joanne. It's a real delight to help out with Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne and to bring this show to our KRFY airwaves and listeners. I wanted to let the listeners know a little bit about you. Dr. Joanne has been a longtime volunteer at KRFY as a broadcaster, previously doing Otto's Eclectic Mix. And now you are hosting your own show, Medical Musing with Dr. Joanne, which airs every first and third Monday of the month at 8 a.m. So who is Dr. Joanne? Dr. Joanne is a retired pediatrician who has lived in Sandpoint since 2010, previously worked as a pediatric practice in Columbus, Ohio for over 30 years, and then covered at Sandpoint Pediatrics as needed once they moved to Sandpoint about 10 years ago. As media spokesperson for Central Ohio Pediatric Society, Dr. Joanne contributed to print, online media, radio, and television. Also, you're a mother of four adult children, and so there you go, Dr. Joanne.
Thank you, Susie. Just a little background. As I was doing my research, I read that the Idaho chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics on their site regarding child abuse prevention led me to the Idaho Children's Trust Fund. And I was so very impressed with how complete their website is and how complete their education is. They are a chapter of Prevent Child Abuse Prevention America and Prevent Child Abuse Idaho. They focus on strengthening the family and providing information to parents about the site that I had never heard of, cryingbabyplan.org. That site teaches the public, especially new parents, of the horrors of shaken baby syndrome. These are all things I knew, but I didn't know how wonderful the resources are really on the web. These initiatives all contribute to the Idaho Children's Trust Fund major goal of child abuse prevention. They have scheduled awareness activities throughout the state in the month of April. In fact, their calendar is called Strengthening Families Month. There's so much information for anyone who wants to be involved in these efforts. There's a national research center from Tufts Medical Center in Boston called HOPE. I like that too, because it stands for Healthy Outcomes from Positive Experiences. And their tagline is Hope Conquers ACEs, and ACEs are Adverse Child Experiences. Both the National AAP Academy of Pediatrics and the Idaho chapter stress the importance to pediatricians and family practitioners to screen for ACEs. It was interesting to me that the Idaho Department of Health gets about 23,000 calls per year about possible maltreatment, and that can go from children on to adults. It's mandatory that anyone who suspects child abuse or any kind of abuse reports, and the reporting is anonymous. The person reporting is immune from civil liability if reporting in good faith. So again, the calls can be from suspected physical or mental abuse to neglect and or abandonment. And then after the cases are evaluated, about one-third are more fully evaluated. So let's start with Tammy, because I know that you are not only a family nurse practitioner and have the extra training as a forensic nurse, but you are also the author of a book, Chronicles of an ER Forensic Nurse. And I love the tagline on that, "The silence is deafening." So tell us about your training a little, and then again, perhaps a few different experiences.
Sure. So training to be a forensic nurse, you have to already be a registered nurse for at least 2 years and then go through what they call SANE training, sexual assault nurse examiner or sexual assault forensic examiner. They're sort of different acronyms throughout the U.S., but it's all the same training. It's a 40-hour class. And then once you complete the class, there is a clinical component to it where you collect acute evidence from either adults or children who have been victimized within a certain time frame where we might find foreign DNA that belongs to a suspect. You are trained in trace evidence collection from the human body, forensic photography, and then you also are required to do a certain amount of observation of expert witness testimony in a courtroom, typically between 16 and 20 hours of that observation, because as a trained forensic nurse, you are considered an expert in a court of law. And that's really scary in the beginning, really scary.
But it's so important to speak up for both the children and or an adult who's had some, been the result of, has sustained intimate partner violence.
Yeah. You know, and at first I was pretty intimidated to be that expert witness. But when you get into sort of all of the granular details of some of these cases, you realize you really are the expert when you're in a courtroom. Most people don't know or what they perceive as a victim is all the same, and it's just really not accurate. And the other thing is when you are caring for, especially children who maybe are prepubescent, and the anatomy and what is injury and what's not injury, a lot of providers, physicians, nurse practitioners, PAs also don't know all of the details. And so you really are the expert. That was just scary to be that person the first few times. You know, it ebbs and flows. You can have five cases in a week or go a whole month without a case. You just never really know.
It's interesting. At Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, they actually had a child abuse center where, again, they had trained nurses, social workers, or a psychologist that did the interview and how important it is not to lead the child. So how to be absolutely just questioning and trying to draw out the child, being as positive as you can be so the child will talk to you. When we spoke previously, I love the quote, and you alluded to this before, I am overwhelmed by the silence that surrounds so much violence. It is right in front of all of us, yet so many never see it. And it's so very true. We do hear reports in the news that shock us probably, you know, not once a week, but once a month. You'll see a little article down buried on the newspaper about a child that was neglected or starved, kept in a closet, or girls that were being trafficked and lived in the basement of a house. And the neighbors don't even know or aren't willing to report, or they don't notice. And that's just always been so interesting to me that these things can go on in cities all around the country of various different sizes. Do you want to share any of your specific experiences or?
Sure. I mean, there's unfortunately plenty to choose from. It's been, you know, almost 18 years of this. So, I do agree. I think it is really important to provide that awareness. Most people are, or especially children, are assaulted by someone they know, or a very close, whether if it's not a family member, it's, you know, somebody that's lived next door for 25 years that the entire community trusts. It's very rarely a stranger. One of the probably most prominent cases that I think of all the time was in a different state, an 11-year-old female. I got a call into the emergency room to come and examine her. She was found at a local mall with an elderly gentleman who someone in the mall thought it was odd. Just their interaction was odd. But they were in the mall, then they left. And about an hour and a half later, the same person saw the same little girl with another man, an adult male, who was doing some shopping with her and then left. And by the afternoon, this person had seen her with a third adult male. And so they were like, okay, something's going on. They called the police. This little girl was found to be exploiting herself on Craigslist. She was having gentlemen meet her at the local mall, take her inside to shop and buy things that she wanted, and then they would go across the hotel, and they would then have sex with her. And I was very sort of taken back by how this was just matter of fact to her. It was just a discussion. It wasn't a big deal. It just seemed like everyday life to her. I found out that her mother had previously been murdered by her mom. Her mom was a prostitute, and it was her pimp, is what the little girl told me, murdered her mother. And so she was living with her grandmother at the time, and her grandmother was not happy about that at all. When her grandmother showed up to pick her up, she actually asked if she could just leave her there and we could call CPS to come pick her up. And it was just really crazy to me that, you know, and then it made me think, okay, well, maybe what's been going on over the mom's life that then now the little girl is suffering, you know, all of the things, and that just sort of continuation of abuse and neglect. And then this little girl, you know, typically when we find someone or treat someone for sexual assault, we don't test them for STDs because it's maybe too soon for it to be picked up. So we treat them as though they were exposed to everything. And all this little girl wanted was to make sure if any medicine she was going to take, she wanted to make sure it wouldn't hurt a baby in case she was pregnant from that day. She said,
my goodness,
she just wanted someone to love her.
Oh, how very, very sad. So, wow. Do you have any estimate of the incidents in Ohio, North Ohio, Northern Ohio specifically, Jesse? Or
I can speak from my experience. So right now we have 35 active court cases in Bonner and Boundary County. And we have, like I said, 20 advocates serving those cases. And that involves 75 children, those 35 cases. And so that's where we're currently at. And those cases come from a variety of sources. We have, I would say, maybe 5% of our cases are sexual abuse cases. And we do have quite a few teenagers that qualify as abandonment cases. We also have several physical violence cases. And then we have cases where the parents have a severe substance abuse issue. One of our recent ones was a baby that was sheltered when law enforcement was called out on a traffic scene. Law enforcement delivered the baby in the car, but the baby was taken to the hospital later that day, and tests indicated that the baby had very high levels of fentanyl and methamphetamine in its system. And so that's something we see pretty routinely.
That's really interesting, because when I did cover at Sandpoint Peds, Dr. Gilbert was so involved in the foster care system. And one day the nurse said to me, well, tomorrow you're going to do 7 shelters. I went, what? Shelters? And that's what they call it. And you just called it, you know, here in Idaho, that's the initial exam to the baseline physical exam and history as the child is getting placed in a foster care, whether it's a temporary, usually temporary to begin with. And some of those children were, again, families of divorce, families where the parents fight all the time, where drugs were involved. And some were newborns. I mean, I'll never forget the newborn born on Tuesday night, and this was Wednesday morning, and she came in with a lovely parent, all dressed in a little pink onesie, and this lady had like 3 or 4 boys. And I said, wow, how did you know you were getting a girl? And she said every time they had a shower, someone gave her some, you know, they didn't know what the sex was. So she had a collection of girl things. And I would love to know now, you know, where that child is and what happened. But routinely, at least at that time, Bonner General, when they were delivering babies, tested for drugs or got really thorough histories. And that was one of the big concerns here. Meth was such a concern when we first moved here. So again, the mechanisms vary. You can have a shaken baby who has head injuries, intentionally broken bones, head traumas. Children can be burned with cigarettes. It's just amazing. And the drugs we talked about, mental and emotional abuse, And then, of course, intimate partner violence and sex trafficking. Again, I was introduced to the medical side of child abuse as a medical student. First-year students were assigned to an attending physician for the romance of medicine. My preceptor happened to be the child abuse doctor. So while other students were listening to hearts and lungs and looking in ears and throats, I was looking at retinal hemorrhages, which means bleeding in the back of the eye from a shaken baby, or looking at their bruises and the supporting x-rays, or hearing in the ER that, you know, so-and-so came in for a, you know, broken arm, but they did a skeletal survey because they were suspicious it was the third visit, and there were multiple fractures in other bones. So, I mean, it is such a, you hate to say common, not common, but as we said, it just covers so many different socioeconomic levels, and it's happens in almost every city. Tammy, when you were working, were there clues on history and physical exam that increased your suspicion? I mentioned the multiple ER visits for random reasons, but other things too?
Sure. Of course, you would have injuries that maybe didn't fit the mechanism that the parents or the whoever brought them in explained. Normal bruising patterns for children, if you're in the medical field, you'll know where those would be and where they shouldn't be. If a child falls, they're not going to get a bruise on their abdomen most of the time. It's going to be on their knees or their elbows, maybe their forehead. But, you know, so mechanism of injury that maybe didn't make sense for what we were seeing. Also, you kind of can pick up on just the interaction between the kid and whoever brought them in and if that's appropriate. Another thing that we realized was also helpful or helped point us in that direction sometimes was multiple addresses. If a kid has been seen multiple times and every time they're there, there's a different address, that kind of alerts us too that there might be something going on. If neglect or abuse, maybe just disparities, that could just be it. But we found that a lot with trafficking victims. There's multiple addresses on file.
Again, I was looking at things that I didn't necessarily study when I was in med school, and the 10 for faces, and that is what you were talking about, the non-accidental places. Mm-hmm. 10, torso, ears, and neck. You don't usually get an accidental injury there. The frenulum, the little piece of tissue that holds your tongue down or your upper lip. And the angle of the jaw or fleshy parts of the cheek. You don't usually fall on those. Parents would call hysterically when that children got a hematoma on their forehead, meaning a big bruise. And I'd say, you know, is it hard? Did it come up really fast? And is it hard? Then it's above the bone. If you didn't see it at first, but then it kind of appears and it's more soft and spongy, then you probably, there could be a skull fracture. And because those come up slowly, but those hard knots that we've all had that mothers put ice on or a cold knife or something like that, those are really okay if basically in that frontal bone. And then, of course, the eyelids and the, as I talked about before, the retinal hemorrhages was really something as a first year med student to look in the back of someone's eye with an ophthalmoscope. You felt like you were a real doctor, but what you were looking at was not really what you know, hopefully you didn't need to use frequently, but of course you were learning how to use everything. You also said to me, listen to your gut. I thought that was another really interesting quote. Tell us a bit about reporting to Child Protective Services, or as we call it, CPS.
Sure. Man, you do have to listen to your gut. I can't tell you the number of people, whether they were, you know, adults or parents of child victims that said, I knew something was wrong, or they were uncomfortable for some reason. And we so quickly dismissed that feeling. And if so many people would listen to their guts, a lot of this would be prevented just by, you know, I see kids for well checks all the time, and I tell the parents that, you know, we talk about it's okay if your child doesn't want to give someone a hug, don't make them. They can shake hands, they can give a high five if they want to, but they have to be the boss of their own body. And if they're uncomfortable with something, let them be uncomfortable with it, and it's okay. So many, I just remember them. go give him a hug, go give him a hug, give him a kiss, give him a kiss. And if they are not comfortable with it, then don't make them do it. Don't make them do it.
Okay. And the state does have a reporting line, 855-552-KIDS, and the number for kids is 5437. So, again, neighbors, friends, someone who's suspicious. Again, my dramatic things from being a pediatrician were often not, I guess I shouldn't say often, but depends if I was seeing patients in the ER for the hospital, was different than being called from our practice. And the one that I really, two that I really think of were with caretakers, and they were shaking babies. And, you know, you get called to the ER because your patient had been taken there and they had been with a babysitter, and then they had retinal hemorrhages and certain things like that. It was just so, so very sad.
I think that's why a lot of daycares now have cameras that you can just, they're live feeds. And if your kid goes there, you have access to it and you can just open it up and see. And a lot of people have nanny cams and things like that for that reason.
Mm, yeah, definitely. Jesse, you had mentioned being a foster parent, and I thought it was very interesting that, again, when I was reading about the Idaho Health and Welfare Department, that they are really working to double the rate of licensed foster homes because there are so many children needing foster homes. And they're also working to encourage to give employers FMLA, the paid family leave, so that when you get a foster child, you can spend quality time with them and build a relationship. We are so fortunate that there are several support agencies here in North Idaho. One, of course, is CASA, that we'll be talking with in just a minute. Lilybrook, I learned that there's a wonderful family justice center here called Lilybrook, where you can report there and you can also receive multidisciplinary support. Safe Passage in Kootenai and Strengthening Family Coalition from St. Vincent de Paul. But let's focus on CASA, the Court-Appointed Special Advocates nationwide program that does have representation here in North Idaho. I first heard of CASA in Columbus, Ohio as a volunteer, and then there was a skier friend here in Sandpoint who presented the CASA program to CAL, the Community Assistance League. So I'm very interested in learning more about the program. Jesse, why don't you start?
Yeah, so we have a wonderful group of volunteers here in Bonner and Boundary County, and we're always looking for more volunteers. It's not an easy volunteer position, but for anybody who might be interested in serving at-risk children in our community, you can hop on to the NorthIdahoCASA.org website and express your interest on our website. I will be doing a training here pretty soon for a group of new advocates. And all of our advocates go through 30 hours of pre-service training. All of our advocates have continuing education of a minimum of 12 hours every year in addition to that. And so if you are willing to represent what you believe is in a child's best interest in front of a judge, and you're willing to meet with that child on a regular basis, you would be a good candidate for our program.
How many retired lawyers or paralegals do you get versus, you know, people who don't have that basic or background legal experience?
We have advocates with the most amazing backgrounds. Right now, on our advocacy team, we have one doctor who's actively working in an emergency room in Spokane. We have several retired attorneys and a couple of active attorneys. We have several advocates that worked in our education system or worked in the medical system. So usually the type of advocates that are attracted to our program do have a background, which makes them more qualified coming into this position. But the most important qualification is that they have a heart for children and want to serve children.
Okay. And then Kristen is the director of development, I hear. So why don't you tell us a little bit about what you do for CASA?
So as you had said, CASA is a national organization, but it is run by each state individually. So, for example, Idaho is not a fully funded program. So our seven judicial districts need people like me that can develop relationships with businesses and partnerships with community organizations to help with fundraising and grants. For example, Washington State is a fully funded program. So it is run through the government agency. So at the First Judicial District, we carry on events for our community, fundraise. We receive probably one-third of our funding from grants, both national and, or both federal and state grants. So I always like to say that I get to do the fun stuff. So we have events here in Sandpoint. In the spring, we have our Ray of Hope Luncheon, which is an awareness event, as well as in November, we have our famous purse party that we've had for almost 20 years now.
Wow.
So, keeping up the partnerships and the awareness in the community, I also want to recognize the Kinderhaven Foundation. We were just awarded a $10,000 grant from them because our needs for drug testing through the courts for the parents and the kids in the homes when they are getting ready to be reunified was brought to our attention. And so we are partnering with a local drug agency to test hair follicles because that gives us a three-month history on both the parents and the children in the household. So thank you to the Kinderhaven Foundation for that opportunity for us to be able to fund that very much needed program.
Now, Kinderhaven was an actual home for the children. Of course, now we've lost that ability, but I'm so glad and gratified that they've continued with the foundation and the fundraising. Jesse, why don't we go back to the program, the training program, actually. So if I came in and said, I'd like to be a guardian ad litem, which is what the volunteers are actually called, what would I do?
Well, you would let me know that you're interested. You could fill out the form on our website, or you could also reach out to me. The local office number here in Sandpoint is area code 208-255-7408. Yes, and so the process of training involves learning about, as you mentioned before, adverse childhood experiences, learning about trauma, learning how to provide trauma-informed care, recognizing signs of child abuse, learning how to conduct an independent investigation at the beginning of a case and write the corresponding report that must go to the court before the adjudicatory hearing. And all of our new advocates do get a mentor, which is a seasoned advocate that will step along beside them. And in addition to me being available to answer questions, they have their mentor that can also answer questions and be there to help them as they learn this challenging volunteer position. I would estimate that our volunteers put in an average of 3 to 5 hours of a week of work per case. So, you know, I don't want to leave the impression that this is an easy, you know, easy volunteer job that will just take, you know, a few minutes a week. But yeah. And then of course, our ongoing training, we've had wonderful trainers. We've had the judges come in to train our volunteers. We've had prosecutor's office and attorneys come in to provide training. We've had various community organizations such as probation and counselors that are local provide training. And so there really is a lot of support for anyone that does want to become an advocate.
So how many people are trained each year, or is there a common number?
Yeah, so here in Bonner County, we train an average of about 6 individuals per year. So
And is there a common time that people stay with you?
Oh my goodness. So the longevity of advocates in our program is actually very, very high. We have, I think our longest standing advocate has been with us for 13 years. And our newest set of advocates were trained last fall. So, but I would say the average is about 5 years or so. And so because of the level of support we offer, I feel like we advocates do stay with us for a long time.
That's wonderful. That really means your training was meaningful and they're really invested in the program. So again, it takes about, if somebody would be volunteering, they'd be doing, no one knows. I mean, some people are obviously going to write a report very thoroughly and redo it and redo it and redo it and take hours and hours. And some people are going to be much more efficient. So I suppose the actual daily workload is can't always say that. And then most volunteers manage one case. I know some must do two if you have 75 children and 30 plus volunteers.
Yeah, so our new advocates, we try not to overwhelm them, and so we start people off with one case. But some of our more seasoned advocates have learned how to do their jobs really well and can handle two or three cases. And so it's always up to the advocate, though, whether or not they want to accept a case. So no one is forced to accept a case if they don't feel comfortable.
So and then the clients can also... But basically, how do you get the clients, I guess, is one of my questions.
Yeah. So in this state, CASA is only assigned after the court becomes involved. So at the beginning of a case, the judge will write what is called a guardian ad litem order that they sign. It's a 3-page document which outlines what the CASA advocate's responsibilities are, what their duties are, and then the powers that they have. We're able to pull records that otherwise may not be accessible, as well as interview various people involved in the child's life to really gain an overall picture of what's going on for that particular child.
So, Tammy, we talked a little bit about... you know, there are many more reportings than the cases that move on. So you were part of, I assume, both the history taking and the evidence presenting to see if a case should move on. Is that part of what you did or not really?
So any time that there is a report of a potential child abuse, child neglect, sexual abuse, the first contact is usually law enforcement. Law enforcement has been trained. They've received what's called minimal facts training. They take the report and then they forward that on, and then the detectives will decide after their interviews whether or not that case needs to be what they call scheduled for forensic interview. So forensic interviews are at Lilybrook, the advocates there are trained forensic interviewers. And so when you talked about earlier about how not asking leading questions and stuff like that, they're very well trained to make sure that they're getting meat and potatoes of what's going on. And then from that interview that is watched by the rest of the multidisciplinary team, your detectives, some of the prosecuting attorneys are there. They can watch the interviews, multiple people from law enforcement and Idaho Health and Welfare, if needed. They watch the interviews, and then together they decide if there is a need for a medical exam, and then also if there is enough evidence to move forward with charges.
Okay. Back to recruitment of volunteers. So do you mainly recruit your volunteers from the fundraising things that Kristen's involved with, or people here from other people on the board? Is there a common way that volunteers are recruited?
We always have a recruitment aspect in all of our events. We like to say that our advocates are the walking billboards of our program. So as Jesse said, it is a hard but so rewarding volunteer opportunity. So we just encourage our advocates to talk about the positives that they encounter, but also at the end of the day, you are really representing the child. And so many of our children need that one positive adult in their life. There are statistics about better school attendance, bigger dreams, that when you have a stable adult that is encouraging and positive, it really does make a difference in the future of these kids. And we all know that past traumas, a lot of this is generational. This is not just a situational trauma. This is generations upon generations. And we really do our best to instill all of that positivity in these children so they know that they can have a better life and they can break that cycle of abuse and generational trauma.
Wonderful. Just want to do a little station ID. This is 88.5 KRFY, and we are talking with Tammy Ndiemi, who's a family nurse practitioner and works at Kinnickzu Community Health, along with Kristen Ludwig and Jesse Sheldon from CASA, court-appointed special advocates. Kristen, you talked a little bit about the grant. So the Idaho Council on Domestic Violence does give some money, is that correct? And then all your other fundraising and development.
Yes, so ICDVVA, or better known as VOCA, is Direct to Victim Services. That is a federal funded grant that we've received since 2019, which has allowed us to cover salaries of our advocate supervisors. And then that would allow fundraising to come in and support additional programs outside of court. Especially through COVID, we found that there was a lot of needs with these families that were not being met. So we provide those programs or those extended programs through some of our fundraising. And those programs change based on the needs of the community. Like I had said, the Kinderhaven Foundation grant was written because we had that need to supply funds for that drug testing that the Department of Health and Welfare did not have all the time. So, and we know that parents cannot afford to pay for a $300 drug test. So that is something that we are willing to step in and be able to provide to ensure the safety of the reunification of that family for those kids.
Tell us about your community partners. All the organizations and all the stores here in Sandpoint get asked so many, many times, but you must have some special angels for you in community partners.
Well, I have a favorite, Finn and McDonald. The Tates are very generous. They always help out with our purse party and our Ray of Hope event in Sandpoint. Bonner County General is a huge supporter of us as well. Laura Gamble has been a advocate for CASA for years, since I've been part of the organization since 2017. And our first judicial program is 30 years in 2023. So we started in 1993 here in the First Judicial District. So we do appreciate all of our partnerships up here in Bonner County.
And the First Judicial District covers how many counties?
Five. It's five. The five northern counties.
And so you have a supervisor in each county, is that correct?
Yes.
And they work with their training volunteers and supervising the volunteers.
Yes. So our main office is down in Kootenai County in Coeur d'Alene. And then Jesse works from Bonner County, and our Boundary County supervisor is Kelly Bell.
Very nice. Tell us how we can all get involved as a volunteer or a supporter.
Well, we do like to say that if a lot of people say, well, I can never do that. And we always come back and say, well, if not you, then who? So if you do not have the time to volunteer, or if you feel that your heart just cannot take it, we do have lots of different opportunities as far as fundraising, donating through different endowment funds. We're happy to report that we just created an endowment fund through the Inovia Foundation, and this will be used to help foster kids that age out of the system that want to acquire additional skills, whether through education or skill set, that we would be able to fund those. So we have a very lovely young lady here in Bonner County, Dolly Webb, that we were able to assist with her additional schooling after she aged out of the foster care system. So there are many other Dollies out there, and we're just happy to be able to fund their hopes and dreams.
Well, I know when I spoke to Laura, who's on the board, she said, oh, no, I'm on the board. I could never be a guardian ad litem, but these ladies do a wonderful job. So I was so happy again that you answered my call. Is there anything we've missed from Tammy to Kristen to Jesse?
I just wanted to quickly let everyone know the annual Lilybrook Kids Fair or Carnival is tentatively scheduled for May 31st this year, and that is free to the public, all families and children. It's just your sort of little local carnival, but there is also a fundraising aspect to that much like CASA, Lilybrook get some federal and some state funding, but they do, rely on donations and other foundations to help connect some of these kids and families that we see with other resources. So,
how long have they been here? I was not familiar with their name until the last couple of years.
If I'm being honest, yeah. I've been in Sandpoint for about 3 years, and so in the 90s, the late 90s, okay. I believe, is okay. When Lilybrook was established.
Do you know any more, Jesse?
I do not.
No. Yeah, I was just, like I said, impressed with their booklet, their little flyer, and then I happen to know someone who is utilizing their services. So again, there's so many resources on the web. I mean, the Idaho Children's Trust Fund, the CASA, just CASA.org, or is it CASA North Idaho?
North Idaho, CASA.org.
There we go. So you can all get more and more information. Thank you, Tammy, Jesse, and Kristen. I really appreciate all of your knowledge, and hopefully more people will understand the importance of reporting possible maltreatment and know about the support services we have here in North Idaho. Thank you all for listening to Medical Musings with Dr. Joanne. Please do remember that this is a medical information show. It does not substitute for discussing your concerns with your provider. There is, as I said before, so much information from CASA at NorthIdahoCASA.org. There's actually a 24-hour national domestic violence hotline. I can give the phone number, 1-800-799-7233. And, of course, the Idaho Council on Domestic Violence that we talked about, that can be reached at icdv.idaho.gov. There's a lot of idaho.gov, or every state has their .gov site. So you can find a lot there, along with the Lilybrook Family Justice Center right here in Sandpoint and the Idaho Children's Trust Fund. I was so impressed with all the activities that they have throughout the state in the month of April. Please tune in next month on May 5th when we'll be discussing Brain Tumor Awareness Month with a neurosurgeon and two surviving spouses of glioblastoma patients. This is 88.5 KRFY, Community Radio for North Idaho.